started that discussion last week. We'll kind of do a very, very quick review over those first few verses, and then we'll get into 26 and hopefully a portion of 27 for tonight's study. Just to kind of let everybody know sort of for next week, I think there'll probably be a lot of people traveling. Sarah and us and the kids will all be traveling next Wednesday night. Ryan is going to have a Bible study here in the auditorium, so they're going to take the college class. I think Bob Simpson's trying to determine what his people count might be in the adult 2 class. So it sounds like we might just have one sort of adult college class here in the auditorium. It won't be Ryan's class. He'll have a topic that he'll have for a Bible study next Wednesday night. So we'll have one more week after this on January 1st, which will still be under this quarter. So we'll finish out our study in Acts, sort of Lord willing. So that's sort of the plan for the next 2 weeks. So let's begin together with a word of prayer. So last week we just began to talk a little bit about the 26th chapter. This is where we find that Paul is before Agrippa. He's allowed to sort of speak for himself. As Paul stretched out his hand and he answered for himself, and he's happy to speak to King Agrippa. And the difference between speaking to Festus and speaking to Agrippa, Agrippa knew more about the sort of laws about the Jews, about the sort of customs perhaps that were there. It doesn't seem that he necessarily believed the same thing Paul does, at least in terms of the Jewish faith. And it doesn't seem he really believes in, the more I read about it this past week, that he believes in the resurrection because of a statement that he makes that Paul returns to him. So as we look through here and we see that he is certainly happy that he is able to speak to him, Paul goes on to talk a little bit about his early life and the manner which from a youth, all of these things he knew. He lived as a Pharisee, and he says, I stand before you now, I'm judged for the hope of the promise made by God to our fathers. And again, we've talked about this in previous weeks. He is tying this back to, he is not trying to abolish the Jewish faith at all. He is trying to show that this is a fulfillment of what he and the fathers and what God had laid down for them, the promise to the 12 tribes. And it's for this hope, King Agrippa, that I am accused by the Jews. And this is that statement in verse 8, why should it be thought incredible by you that God raises the dead? So it gives maybe perhaps just a little bit of insight that either he chuckled perhaps when he talks about that. He's trying to understand, or maybe Luke doesn't record for us everything that was sort of said there. But somehow he's thinking, how is it incredible to you to think that God cannot raise the dead? And so he sort of makes that comment to him. But then he goes on to say that indeed I myself thought to do many things contrary to the name of Jesus of Nazareth. And so we know this from previous times. Last week we talked a little bit about this. Paul's mission prior to the road to Damascus was to go and stamp out Christianity. It even talks about the times in which he did these things in Jerusalem. To the saints I shut up in prison, having received authority from the chief priest. Perhaps some of these chief priests are there, the ones that were accusing him of being the one that was turning the world upside down, the one that was, they're sort of talking about him as bringing a Greek into the temple. These same people he knew really well. In fact, he was given charge by them to take Christians to jail. He says, and I punished them often in every synagogue. I compelled them to blaspheme, being exceedingly enraged against them. I persecuted them even to foreign cities. And this is where he sort of brings on to explain to him about his journey to Damascus. And with authority and commission from the chief priest, at midday, O king, along the road I saw a light from heaven, brighter than the sun, shining around me and those who journeyed with me. And we had all fallen to the ground. I heard a voice speaking to me, saying in the Hebrew language, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? It is hard for you to kick against the goads. And so again, he is trying to relay to King Agrippa how he came from being that Pharisee of Pharisees to this one who is now preaching Christianity. So his response is, he says, "So who are you, Lord?" And he says, "I am Jesus whom you are persecuting, but arise and stand on your feet, for I have appeared to you for this purpose, to make you a minister and a witness, both of the things which you have seen and of the things which I will yet reveal to you." And I just want to stop there. What is the commission that Jesus is giving Paul? Gives him two charges. What is it? What's that? Minister and be a witness. So how is he ministering? How does he live a life of ministering?
Everywhere he went, he taught the word of God. He ministered to the people, to their spiritual needs.
Right. So again, this idea of ministering, he wasn't using this road to Damascus to build himself up. It was about being a servant. It was about ministering to people and letting them know what God has done and giving his son for us. But then he's also to be a witness. And how is he a witness?
Paul was most likely heavily involved when Jesus was mocked, tried, and killed.
Okay.
And now says he appeared to me, so Paul saw him.
Right.
He saw Jesus, which is also a requirement.
Sure.
So he is a witness both to his crucifixion and the fact that he must have risen from the dead because he's here talking to him now.
Right. Whether or not, you know, we don't have any recording of the things prior to when Jesus was being on trial, but we understand that his persecution of Christians who followed after Jesus, and so he certainly was in the know about who this Jesus of Nazareth was. We certainly know if, as an apostle, you would have had to have been a witness of the risen Lord. We know on the road to Damascus, he has a personal sort of witness there. He wasn't there right after the resurrection to sort of meet with Jesus as the other apostles had. But also as a witness, what other thing, is he given something else that he can be a witness? What helps him be a witness? Or confirm the things, perhaps, that... So if Jesus tells him certain things and now he's able to tell people, how is he confirming that Jesus told me that? Does he have some... I mean, I'm asking you things to think what I'm thinking about, Branson. Okay. Right. Yet you reveal to you. And so as a witness, he's going to be a witness to things that the other apostles would not necessarily have gotten because they had the opportunity to be with Jesus. And so Paul now has this opportunity because he has this revelation directly from Jesus. And so as this witness to the risen Lord, but he also has this ability to, with power and miracles and things that he's able and wonders that he's able to do, he can confirm the things that Jesus told me this, and I'm going to confirm that he told me this because of the power that I have that came from God, came from Jesus. And so he's using this thing as both this minister to serve the people in which he is going to be have this capacity, but also the idea that he's going to be able to be a witness, of the things that you have seen and witnessed to the things that I have yet to reveal to you. But he's also going to remind him and tell him, and it's interesting that he sort of gives this information to King Agrippa because he says, I'm going to deliver you from the Jewish people as well as from the Gentiles to whom I will now send to you to open their eyes in order to turn them from darkness to light and from the power of Satan to God, that they may receive forgiveness of sins and an inheritance among those of the sanctified by faith in me. So it's interesting that, you know, Paul understands this, and we have talked in previous weeks about the fact that it must have been at least comforting to Paul to have Jesus tell him, here's what you're going to do. You're going to go to Rome. So all of these things can happen, all these plots against him to kill him in Jerusalem. He knows he has another mission. He knows he is going to Rome. That these things might happen in the future, but at least not until he gets to Rome will those things happen. And so he's now even sort of expressing that to King Agrippa, that while he's in custody now and the Jews have tried to sort of put him to death, God has told him that he's going to deliver him from those people. But he has a purpose in doing that. And we've talked about this in previous weeks as well. You know, he's standing before King Agrippa and he is preaching to him the gospel. He is preaching to him the things that he needs to understand, that this God that I am talking to you about, you need to be forgiven of your sins. And so he is trying to, speaking to him to defend himself. It's not about necessarily his own life preservation. It is about trying to portray to King Agrippa and any of those in the audience what God has done and what God has done for all of mankind, both Jew and Gentile. Comments or questions?
He also Larry? Had quite a few witnesses to the life. They didn't hear the voice.
Right.
But when he's telling this story, there were a whole bunch of people traveling with him said, well, yeah, that
happened. Right. And he was blinded. I mean, something happened on that road to Damascus, and whether or not some of those people, as Paul goes on and he goes a different direction, I don't know if the others went back to Jerusalem, describe what happened to Paul at that particular time. We're not told what happened, and we're not told if they gave that information on to the chief priest at that particular time. But what we see here, we find that he is trying to make sure that this gets portrayed to King Agrippa, again, starting with his early life and how he ends up here. And he's going to deliver for him in just a moment why it is that the people have brought him before King Agrippa. Yeah, Jim?
I can't help but think, you know, he uses some very choice words when he's authoring his defense. Mm-hmm. But that idea about the hope that he presents, you know, how ironic it is that that's what he's, when he first gets the opportunity to say, you know, why am I on trial? I'm on trial for the hope, not only the hope that I have, but the hope that the 12 tribes have.
Right.
And so, you know, the appeal he's making there is, brethren, my fellow Jews, you've lost sight of the fact that God instilled in us as his chosen people to have hope for the future. All I'm coming to tell you now is that hope is real.
Right.
That
right.
hope has been realized. So it's very ironic to think that the defense that he offers there is still trying to work on their hearts to convince them to see through, you know, what they're missing.
Right.
And then it's ironic to think how much they're missing.
Right.
I mean, there are people that have settled into this comfort zone of being the Jews and having their rules and their regulations, and it really looks like they've stopped looking forward to having that hope. Although even in his encounters with his disciples, we see them thinking, "Oh, here's the hope. We're about to see Jerusalem, you know, back in its rightful place, the center of the universe, and you know, one of God's people back on the throne, and all of that." So they just really were missing the boat. But Paul's not giving up on them. Even in this, when they mean harm to him, he still means good for them.
That's right. That's right. Other thoughts or comments? So as he picks it back up in verse 19, he says, "Therefore, King Agrippa, I was not disobedient to the heavenly vision." We think about what does it take, perhaps, to have that sort of life-changing thing to happen. I mean, Paul was going, on the road to Damascus, you know, to put Christians, to bring them back to Jerusalem, to put them to death or put them into prison. But something happened on the road, and he had this vision, and he wasn't disobedient to that call. He got the call and he answered the Lord in terms of that heavenly vision. He says, "But I declare first to those in Damascus and in Jerusalem and throughout all the regions of Judea and then to the Gentiles that they should repent, turn to God, and do the works befitting repentance. And these reasons, the Jews seized me in the temple and tried to kill me." And so that's where he is beginning to sort of bring to King Agrippa's sort of knowledge is that, you know, they can say it was about bringing a Jew into the or bringing a Gentile into the temple, or they can say it was about me sort of creating sort of mass hysteria or creating riots, but But this is the reason. They're doing that because of what I preached. That's why they brought you before me. And for these reasons, the Jews seized me in the temple and tried to kill me. Therefore, having obtained help from God, to this day I stand witnessing both to the small and great, saying no other things than those which the prophets and Moses said would come. And again, he is trying, again, to get those Jewish brethren to understand where he's coming from. This is exactly what the prophets and Moses was said would come. And this is that fulfillment. And that Christ would suffer, that he would first rise from the dead and proclaim light to the Jewish people and to the Gentiles. And we know in the past that when Paul is sort of preaching to the crowd there in Jerusalem, when he tries to tie the Jews and the Gentiles together, he understands that, you know, the Jews aren't going to like that, but that's what God had done. He brought these two together. Now, he did proclaim it first to the Jewish people. That nation was the one who was to receive it first. They also should have been the one to understand it first and easier. But yet, sometimes we find that it was easier to go to the Gentiles, and that was Paul's commission after first preaching to the Jewish people. Thoughts or comments up to here? Mark? Right, exactly. Yep. Other thoughts or comments? And then in verse 24, he says, And now thus made his defense, Festus said with a loud voice, Paul, you are beside yourself. Much learning is driving you mad. Why do you think Festus has that response? What are the things that he says that he would think that someone is mad? Resurrection of the dead, possibly. Yeah.
What else? Saying in open court that the Jews have forgotten what the prophets and Moses said.
Right. Yeah.
I'm telling you what they said.
Right. Yeah, Mark.
This concept that the Messiah would come and suffer and die.
Right. Sure. Right. Paul goes on to write to the Corinthian brethren to tell them that, you know, the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing. Festus doesn't get it. He just doesn't. He didn't get it previously. His hope is, as Paul tries to preach to King Agrippa, at least he has some background of the Jewish faith. And so perhaps there can be more of a tie to King Agrippa. But as Festus is sitting here listening, he would rather sort of, in a sense, sort of mock or just make fun of Paul as he is trying to tell the story of his conversion and how he's come to know a better way and has given his life for Christianity at this particular time and is willing to take this all the way to Rome. Those like Festus just see this as foolishness. And he says to them, I'm not mad, most noble Festus, but speak the words of truth and reason. And again, that's something that I think we need to understand. People might say similar things to us, that we are sort of foolishness perhaps when they can't see that clarity. But we have to understand that we need to be able, just as Paul did, to be able to teach to them in truth and reason, and not just dismiss them or get upset because they're calling us foolish. I mean, Paul's using this argument, and he's going to use truth and reason to try to convince these people of the things that he is trying to say. And picking up in verse 26, "For the king before whom I speak freely knows these things, for I am convinced that none of these things escapes his attention, since this thing was not done in a corner." So he understands who Jesus was. He understands the things that this resurrection of the dead, at least had heard about the things that were going on. And so King Agrippa says, "Do you believe the prophets?" And so he point blank comes out and just asks King Agrippa, "Do you believe the prophets? Do you believe the things that the prophets foretold about?" And says, then King Agrippa said to Paul, "You almost persuade me to be a Christian." Thoughts or comments up to this point?
Sort of back to the idea, Stacy, on Festus, because I wonder too, it's right after he's talking about this idea of resurrection that we see this. And so I think we would make that connection. But if you read back to 25, if you remember verse 9, it says, "But Festus, wishing to do the Jews a favor, answered Paul and said, 'Are you willing to go up to Jerusalem and stand trial before these charges?'" So there's an idea that Festus and the Jews are sort of, they have a nice little relationship.
Right.
There's likely been some exchange of money, and he's someone looking to preserve that relationship. And what he sees Paul doing here is discrediting these people, and this is his attempt to sort of put Paul, hey, don't worry, I'm still your guy.
Right.
Still need that income.
whatever it is,
this relationship.
Sure.
And we see it with politicians, right? I mean, they're pandering to one side or the other, and that's almost what we see here is he's being a politician, right? He recognizes this alliance. He's got with these influential Jews. He's trying to preserve that. And so he really is sort of mocking Paul in this way.
Right.
To the benefit of the Jews, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah, Kip. I couldn't hear you.
Paul's got Festus in the corner.
Yeah.
He can't disagree with him.
With the things they said, yeah.
Because he's going to upset the crowd and he doesn't win the prophets. He doesn't have a good argument for him. So this is just the side step to just discredit Paul and say, "You can't do it."
Right.
This and everything you're saying.
Right.
I think Festus kind of knew he was in the corner.
Right.
Didn't have a way out of it.
So. Exactly. Other thoughts or comments? Yeah, Branson? Right.
It says the king knows. Peter in Acts 2 started with what they know in verse 22. And also Peter in Cornelius' household in verse 37 told him he knew about the baptism of John and he knew about Jesus of Nazareth.
Right.
It's just a good thing to open with something people know.
Sure. Yeah. Branson's pointing out, I didn't know if you were able to hear, but he's pointing out that Paul is insightful in terms of, and Peter did the same thing on the day of Pentecost. You have to know your audience, and you know where to start. And so as Paul's presenting to King Agrippa and explaining to them that he knows these things, and we need to be able to do the same thing. Know our audience, know where to start as we begin to try to convince people of the faith that we have. Other thoughts or comments? Yeah, Jimmy?
This is sort of just said casually at the end, but in my mind, I sort of see this as the crescendo to everything he said, to then have Agrippa say what he says.
Right.
That's a big exclamation point right there.
Yeah.
The person he's standing in front of that he's giving this defense to is basically saying, "Hey, I know you're of the way, and you're right there about to convince me to be a part of this way as well."
Right.
I can only imagine how that statement must have resounded with that audience, especially with Jews there to hear him say that. That's probably not what they were expecting to happen at all. So
exactly.
It's sort of this is bigger than what
right,
it looks
right.
like.
Sure. Any other comments? And so Paul's response to King Agrippa, he goes, "I would to God that not only you, but all who hear me today." And again, we've been talking about this each week. Paul's purpose, his commission is to convince this audience of the things that Jesus has done and what God has planned all along. And so as he points out to them, "King Agrippa, that's great that I almost persuade you. But I would hope that everybody in this audience can be convinced of the things that I am saying. And I would hope we would be the same here. He says, to all here, we might both and almost all together, such as I am, except for these chains. And so he would hope that they all have the faith that he has and be just like him, but you probably don't need to be in chains. And so that would be my hope for everybody in this audience. And when he had said these things, the king stood up, as well as the governor and Bernice and those who sat with them. And when they had gone aside, they talked among themselves, saying, "This man is doing nothing deserving of death or chains." And King Agrippa said to Festus, "This man might have been set free had he not appealed to Caesar." And so this is something that Luke is able to provide for us through inspiration. It's not something necessarily, it sounds like they shared necessarily with Paul at that particular, this was something in the comments, they, almost as if they're walking out of the room going, "Man, I don't understand why these people brought this man here, and there is no reason he should have death or even in chains right now. And had he not appealed to Caesar, maybe he wouldn't even be having to go to Rome." Now, we know that's a different plan that God had. But you know, his comment here that, you know, Agrippa saying he might have been set free, the problem would have been Festus, because Festus had the opportunity to set him free, and he chose not to try to be able to befriend the Jews at that particular time. And it's Festus' problem that he asked King Agrippa for his advice, because he's kind of in a position where, "I don't know what to do. The man's appealed to Caesar, and I don't really have a charge to lay against him, but yet he's got to go to Caesar." And so as King Agrippa is leaving, he's like, "Man, I don't know what you're going to do, because I don't see any way in which he needs to be deserving of death or chains, and the man really should have been set free." And that kind of leaves Festus with a little bit of a problem. Thoughts or comments as we sort of finish up chapter 26? Yeah, Mark? Right.
This man is doing nothing.
So right.
They recognize he's not done, and then
right.
He's been in front of us saying the same thing he's been saying.
Right.
So he's not backing away from it. He's not
right.
Remorseful that he got caught or whatever. This man is continuing to do this.
Right.
And they're okay.
Right, right. And again, the things that he was saying in the synagogue and in the temple are the same things that he was preaching to King Agrippa, and they're like, "We're hearing these things. I don't understand why people are having this issue. Why should this man be in chains?" But the words that he's saying, this is nothing that he should be put in prison for. It's nothing that he should be put, certainly not deserving of death, because I'm hearing the same things. But he understands that this is an issue with the Jewish leaders, and their problem now is becoming an issue for them in terms of now his appeal to Caesar. Any other comments? So we're going to see as we journey with Paul here in the next couple of weeks, as they leave sort of Caesarea, they're going to kind of sail sort of inland. I mean, this particular time, you don't really sail much in the open Mediterranean. They somewhat kind of stay, at least, I wouldn't necessarily say it's within eye shot of shore, but at least try to stay hugging the banks closer than really trying to sail. So as we'll see here, that they go from Sidon, they're going to sort of hop the coast and go north of Cyprus, and then tonight we'll sort of end probably somewhere around sort of Fair Havens or so. So now he's going to begin his journey to Rome, and it was decided that they should sail to Italy. And as they delivered Paul and some of the prisoners, named Julius, a centurion of the Augustan regiment, also entering a ship of the Adriaticum to put to sea, meaning to sail along the coast of Asia. But he had some people go with him. So it wasn't necessarily, we're going to, you know, put him in these chains and send him off by himself with the other sort of criminals. He was allowed some liberty in the sense that he was able to take Aristeus, as well as, he says, with us, and so Luke's with him as well at this particular time, so he's on this voyage to Rome. So the next day they land at Sidon, and then Julius treated Paul kindly and gave him liberty. So at Sidon, he's actually able to go and visit with friends and have some care, receive care at that particular port city. And when they had put back to sea again, they sailed under the shelter of Cyprus. And then from that map, that was sailing north of Cyprus between there and the coast of Asia, because the winds were contrary to them. And when they had sailed over the sea, which is off Sicilia to Pamphylia, we made our way to Myra, the city of Lycia. Then the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing to Italy. And so, again, they go from port to find places in which they can get on the next ship to go towards where their ending point will hopefully be in Italy. And so they put us aboard, and when they had sailed slowly many days, they arrived with difficulty off of Cnidus, and then the winds were not permitting us to proceed, so we sailed under the shelter of Crete off Salmos. And having passed with difficulty, we came a place called Fair Havens near the city of Lycia. And so this was a particular time we find that when they're sort of traveling, it's not particularly evidently a great time of year. We're going to find that the fast in verse 9, we're talking about the sort of Day of Atonement. So this is what we call today sort of Yom Kippur. So it's late September, early sort of October is when this typically happens during the year. Evidently, this was not the time to necessarily be sailing, at least on certain portions of this voyage. And Paul makes a point here, and this will sort of wrap up our sort of discussions and take some other comments here before we go much further tonight. Because Paul makes a comment here in verse 10. He says, "Men, I perceive that this voyage will end with disaster and much loss, not only of cargo and ship, but also our lives." Is that really what, if we've read ahead, is that what's going to happen? What about the lives portion of it? Does that happen? The life portion doesn't. And so I'm curious, while Paul sort of points out that, well, there's certainly, we find that they are going to be shipwrecked and they're going to lose cargo and things like that. Do you think perhaps Paul just is not given all of that information at this particular time? Because we're going to read later that the Lord actually tells Paul more about, here's a way to preserve life if certain things are done. We're not really told why Paul sort of mentions it in this way, and that he's either because of his upbringing and his understanding, whether it was a warning from Jesus himself that, yeah, there's going to be a disaster and there's potentially going to be some loss of life if you don't do the things that I tell the people to do. But it's interesting here, at least at this point, that he mentions that there can be potentially this disaster and this sort of loss of life. So either Paul doesn't have all of the information yet, and until later when Jesus provides more information to him. Yeah.
And it's all speculation, I think, on our part. However, it appears he's trying to persuade him that, hey, we don't need to go on.
Right.
And so,
right.
You know, if I'm persuading you, I'm not going to be like, well, Stacy, and we might die.
Yeah, that's right.
Stacy,
yeah.
We're going to die.
Right. Right, right.
So, yeah, let's not do
right.
this.
Sure, sure.
And so, you know, I kind of look at it that way, that, and the loss of life, yeah. If the guy hadn't cut the lifeboats loose,
right.
And the people were trying to jump on board,
yep.
Life would have been.
Sure, lost. Sure. And again, you know, we're looking at this from sort of Paul's perspective this time. Paul, perhaps, is looking at it from the standpoint that God has wanted me to get to Rome. And, you know, this is not the weather that we need to be traveling in to accomplish this other goal. And so whether or not he is trying to look out for himself to say, look, we still need to make the other end of this journey, and right now, weather is not favorable for us to do this at this particular time. And whether or not the Lord has been able to share some of that information with him about what the potential is going to happen and gives him this other, we find later that there is this opportunity. Here's how you're going to be able to preserve life. And so he's, again, trying to convince them that this is not the time to go. Scott.
And it may have been a progression that if he hadn't told this, then when they got to that point, and
right.
he says, if they get off, we're dead.
Right, right.
The guy would have been like,
right.
What do you know?
Right. He knew ahead of time. He knew something ahead of time. That
everything else took place.
Right.
Now, if they get off, we're dead.
Right, and right. Gives them another reason to believe the things that he's going to be able to tell them later as well. Other thoughts or comments?
Paul's not omnipotent.
That's right.
Because he's an apostle. God doesn't
right.
tell him everything.
Sure.
He would have understood the pain that he has, the thorn in his side, and he would have understood all those things, and he didn't. And
sure.
Paul was worried many times in his trip, his travels, and
right.
had to comfort him.
Sure.
You're going to be okay.
Right.
So it says what I think it means. Paul perceived.
Right.
Paul had done some traveling.
Sure.
He knew that it's not down here.
Right,
travel.
Right.
And he'd probably seen other voyages in.
Disastrously, sure.
Disastrous. So the difference between this statement and the other one later is the Lord has revealed to me versus
right.
I perceive.
That, good point, yeah. Other thoughts or comments tonight? But again, we look at the centurion, and he's perhaps looking at the experience of this man, perhaps in chains. Nevertheless, the centurion was more persuaded by the helmsman and the owner of the ship than the things that Paul spoke. So at this particular time, he looked at the person whose livelihood it is to either own the ship or run the ship. And if they say it's good weather to go, his biggest concern is, I've got to get these prisoners to Rome. And if this is the way to do it, and they're saying we can, his persuasion is from this other man that owns the ship and the helmsman of the ship. And because the harbor was not suitable to winter in, the majority advised him to set sail from there also by means they could reach Phoenix, which is a harbor of Crete, opening towards the southwest and northwest, and to winter there. So they traveled maybe about 40 miles from the port they were there around to the other side of Crete. And then sort of wintered for that particular time. And then we'll pick up there, not next week, but the week after. Any other comments before we sort of close tonight? We're waiting on the second bell. All right. Thank you for your comments tonight.